So welcome to another edition of the podcast that I, Terry Wenham, call Tales from the Battlefields. And this week, I'm pleased to say we've got a special guest, Simon Jones, a historian that I came across some years ago when I was walking the Battle of Messines. And I read a blog that he'd written about the myths of Messines. And I thought, I was going to try and explain it myself, but I thought, no, let's ask Simon if he'll come on. And I'm pleased to say he took up the invitation. And he talked us through not just what happened at Messines on the 7th of June, 1917, but also what didn't happen. So without any further ado, let's listen to what Simon has to say. This afternoon, as it's the week of the anniversary, what will it be now? 106 years, is it? 106 years since the Battle of Messines. Yeah. We have with us a man called Simon Jones. And Simon's done a lot of work on what happened at Messines in June of 1917. So welcome to the podcast, Simon. I just wonder if you could introduce yourself and explain how you became interested in the Great War in the first place.
Well, thanks, Terry, and thank you for the invitation. It's great to be here. So my interest in, the First World War goes back to teenage years, which is a very long time ago, more than 40 years I've been interested in the Great War. Yeah, I suppose my interest ranged from collecting militaria and I guess model kits. That was the kind of thing in the kind of when you were kind of younger, wasn't it?
But
got you into war. Yes. The 135th scale and sort of thing. And then I was actually lucky enough to get a job in a military museum, in the Royal Engineers Museum. So I was already, I was already really into the First World War. Yeah. But that took me on a particular route, the Royal Engineers. If you haven't been to that museum in Chatham, it's a fantastic museum. Royal Engineers have an amazing history. And that got me into particular aspects of the Royal Engineers. I was already very interested in gas warfare. It also made me interested in underground warfare as well. Mm. I had a short 10-year interlude when I was a curator in Liverpool of the King's Regiment Museum, and then freelance. And so I've been pursuing my own interests. And that's given me the chance to kind of take a really deep dive into topics like underground warfare. Yeah. So I did a book in 2010 on underground warfare. I did another one on gas warfare. Yeah. And I've been doing really in-depth research into British tunnelling and actually French and German tunnelling, all sorts of tunnelling operations during the First World War, focused a lot on Lavoisel, the famous Lochnagar mine. But also, of course, if you're interested in underground warfare and tunnelling in the First World War, then you've got to be interested in the Battle of Messines, June 1917, which was really the kind of pinnacle, if you like, the summit of the achievement of the British tunnellers on the Western Front. So there's a whole lot of aspects that I'm really, really interested in this topic that sort of lasted me a lifetime, really.
Yeah, and we're not finished yet, are we?
We're not, no.
But I think the beauty of the Battle of Messines is that so often we talk on here about the first day of the Battle of the Somme, and what happened at Passchendaele in the latter stages. And it's depressing, to be honest, isn't it? Because we're talking about failure, but not when it comes to the Battle of Messines. We're talking about a tremendous success. So could you just sort of describe the background and what the objectives were in the Battle of Messines and how the Royal Engineers fitted into it?
Well, it had an amazingly long gestation period. So this battle, it's a short battle. It lasts only a little bit more than a week, doesn't it, in June of 1917. But the idea of capturing this ridge, the Messines Ridge, which is it's south of Ypres in Belgium, runs directly south. And it's the kind of continuation of the high ground that surrounds Ypres on sort of three sides, this sort of amphitheatre. And the Germans often likened it to the handle of a sickle. If you imagine the blade of the sickle being the high ground surrounding the town of Ypres, then the handle is the Messines Ridge that runs south of the south of the town. Germans called it the White Sheet Ridge, Wichita Ridge. We call it by Messines. You've got these two really villages on the summit of the ridge. So it's a bit of commanding high ground south of Ypres that the Germans held since the First Battle of Ypres in 1914.
Yeah,
and typically, they have the high ground. The idea of attacking it, that actually attacking it with tunnels, come about in November of 1915. So if you consider it, it's not captured till June 1917,
No,
you
it's
can
a
see
long
what I
time
mean by
before they
this
started
long,
planning then, isn't it?
yeah, this long gestation period. And there's actually some dispute as to whose idea that was. I mean, basically, underground operations, tunneling began shortly after trench warfare itself, October 1914. British are having to do a lot of catching up. The Germans are much better equipped in terms of personnel for digging tunnels beneath the trenches under no man's land, trying to blow up your opposing lines. British found themselves undefended, really, unable to stop the Germans from doing this, digging under their trenches and blowing them up. So they recruit these famous tunneling companies, soldiers, tunnel navvies, called clay kickers, who've been digging Manchester sewers and
So
London
these are
Underground, that sort
professional
of thing.
tunnellers then. These aren't soldiers.
Professional. Yep, professional tunnel navvies
Yeah.
called clay kickers that use this particular technique of digging a low tunnel very quickly through clay. Now it's either Manchester clay, London clay, or works. It's the same clay as you
The
find in
blue
Flanders
clay
as well.
of
The
passion
blue
there, yeah.
clay,
And
exactly. Yes, and they're called.
are these volunteers, and do they
They
form
are
part of the
indeed.
army?
Yeah, they're all volunteers. February 1915, the first ones are enlisted. 17 of them from Manchester. They're offered a rate of 6 shillings a day,
So that's more than
which if
what the
you
Tommies get in then.
exactly the basic infantryman is a shilling a day. A sapper will get an extra, I think, a shilling and about a shilling and tuppence on top of that. So 6 shillings is more like what a
A lot of
sergeant
money.
might get. And they're put to work immediately. They're just put in uniform. They're not given any other military training. They're just put to work, and they're an immediate success. The officers are mining engineers. So you've got these highly specialized, skilled units who have been put to work in Flanders. And they understand the geology very well. Mining engineers, it's their job. One of them in particular, Cecil Cropper, British sort of Anglo-Australian mining engineer, he comes up with an idea of attacking the Messines Ridge. And that is using the geology, using this clay, this blue clay that's beneath a whole lot of very wet sand. And his idea is that they can tunnel through the blue clay very quietly, quickly, and easily, and place mines under the Messines Ridge. So he suggests this to a mining entrepreneur who has been a big leading light in the tunnelers, John Long Griffiths. And he discusses that with his boss, in effect, a staff officer, GHQ, Robert Napier Harvey. And between them, they cook up this plan. And basically, as far as Cropper was concerned, they stole his idea. They
So
stole his idea to place
this is
mines.
even before the Battle of the Somme and the mines that they've blown there. This is happening
Absolutely.
before that.
Absolutely. So this is this plan to place mines in the clay under Messines Ridge is agreed to by the Second Army, which is in the sector here, and its famous General Plumer.
Plumer, yeah.
And
Paddy Plumer.
and he formulates the plan that is agreed to by Haig, who's now the chief commander in chief at the end of 1915, for a plan for an attack that will take place in June 1916. Okay, so June
1916.
1916, they're going to attack Messines Ridge. So the tunnelers work really hard and they get in place several, I forget how many now, something like a dozen or so mines in place ready to explode in June of 1916. And then several things happen and that attack never takes place. So things all get skewed by, the German attack at Verdun, and obviously the Somme
Some offensive, yeah.
becomes the priority.
And then winter
And when
kicks
the
in, yeah. The
Somme drags
longest
on,
winter in history.
So it doesn't then happen until June of 1917, and it becomes the precursor, if you like, the first phase of the Third Battle of Ypres, the Flanders Offensive, that of course is launched at the end of July, isn't it, 1917?
Yes, on the 35th. So is this because to launch the Battle of Passchendaele, what's to become known as the Battle of Passchendaele, Third Battle of Ypres, that they had to clear the Germans off the Messines Ridge so they couldn't see the preparations that were going on for the Third Ypres?
I think that's it. Yes, it's they've got the plan and they've got the mines in place. So it's the obvious thing
To use them.
to do that first, to get that high ground to the south. I mean, there are people that say they should have then made the priority to get the next bit of the high ground, the Menin Road, high ground. As
There were
part of
6 weeks, wasn't
part of
there?
the
There was
attack
about
as well.
6 weeks after
Yeah, so
Messines
there's
before
a
Passchendaele.
exactly the controversial delay between Messines and Passchendaele. So yeah, so it has this long gestation period during which, of course, those mines have to be kept dry, 80 or 100 foot below ground, and it becomes a struggle in itself to keep those mines sort of secret from the Germans,
Because
and
they
also
could have been tunneling the other way, couldn't they, I suppose?
exactly, and they were, yeah,
They
and
were,
they
yeah.
were. So there's not only was it an amazing achievement to get those mines underneath the German positions for June 1916, it was equally amazing to keep them
Keep them,
viable
yeah.
and to keep
And a
them
secret.
secret from the Germans. And in fact, some of the, I mean, as we'll see, it became impossible to keep some of those, some of those mines
Which is why
viable.
one or two of them had to be abandoned. Right, okay, well, for years and years, 20 odd years, I've been going up on the Messines Ridge with different people, and I must admit that some of the stories that I've told them, we're going to completely debunk during the next half an hour or so.
Well, I think that happens to all of us, and also books that were published as we were just discovering. And 20, 30 years ago, books that were coming out maybe in the 1980s were relying on very limited amounts of information. People hadn't
Primary
done the sort of
sources.
deep research in the archives. Sometimes there was just no better information. Sometimes people kind of put two and two together and do get
And
five.
assume
And
something,
so it's a mixture of that that leads to assumptions. And I think I've always just found it more interesting to read primary sources than what other people have written about them, if you see what I mean.
Yeah,
I do
definitely. Yeah,
get,
I'm learning that actually. I'm learning the more I get into this, the more I'm finding that it's always right. The two things really is to read the primary sources and also to challenge everything as well. To say, could that possibly have happened? Is there a, is there more evidence that can either confirm or contradict that piece of evidence that I've just read? It's like being a detective, isn't it?
I think so. And I think that, eventually you'll find the truth can be, every bit of as exciting as the myth, or even more exciting, because it's true after all.
Okay, so I think, when did you do this research? When you wrote that your blog, The Myths of Messines, when did you do that research then?
So this was gathering together work over many years. I think I did, that was 2017. So I was, we were thinking about the centenary.
The
So I was
centenary.
thinking, oh, it'd be good to do something. 2010, I'd done my book Underground Warfare, and I'd sort of told the story of Messines and pulled together what I had about Messines at the time. And I was conscious that there were things that didn't add up. I think about the were the mines heard at Downing Street by the
Let's
Prime
start with
Minister,
that
for
one then. So we've
example.
got let's pick these off one by one then, because we've got four myths that you've really identified. We've got the big bang in Downing Street where the window shook. We've got the fact that there was the story that was 10,000 Germans killed directly by the mine explosions and not by anything else. We've got the story that Irishmen were killed by the spoil of the of one of the mines.
Spanbrook Merlin,
I can't even say that's bang. And I still struggle with that. I called it the Lone Tree later.
It's easier.
And then the story of the lost mines, which we've touched upon. So you've just mentioned there the Big Bang, and what I've read is that the people in Lille, which is about 15 miles away, they thought it was an earthquake. How did this claim that the Prime Minister heard the explosion in Downing Street? How did that occur? And why do you believe that it's not true? I think they're the three issues.
As I was gathering descriptions of mines going off, and these are, mines buried deep underground, ranging from a few tons to, many, many tons, 20 tons or something, huge amounts of explosives. It was striking that very few, if any, of the accounts talked about a bang when these mines detonated. They talked about the ground shaking and it's feeling like an earthquake. The actual eyewitness accounts don't tend to talk about a bang.
They're talking about the guns, aren't they?
So I sort of decided to look into it, and in particular, the eyewitness accounts of tunnellers. They just don't talk about a bang. So the first thing was to try to find the origin of this, because it's the story is that the Prime Minister, Lloyd George,
Lloyd
was
George,
in
sorry.
Downing Street and heard the mines go off at 3:10 in the morning, 7th of June.
Yeah.
So first, I was trying to find the source of it. And the earliest reference I could find was in the Times newspaper. And it says that he did hear the mines going off. He was up ready because he obviously he'd had advance notice.
Yeah.
But the newspaper account says he was at home. He was in Walton Heath in Kent. He wasn't in Downing Street. Yeah. But I mean, that's still a long way. And it's actually sort of pretty much the same distance, Kent, Downing Street. So people have obviously picked up on that, and it's turned into Downing Street, and it's more dramatic, isn't it, story?
Yes.
And this was indeed reported at the time. And then I found that the internet is just fantastic for finding, the internet's great for finding bad information, but it's also really good for finding good information. So I was— you can pin down. So there's a scientific journal, Nature, reported this at the time, highly respected journal, reported that the sound had been heard. And then in the next issue, some Royal Engineers, unnamed Royal Engineers, who'd witnessed the explosion said, no, we were there. It didn't make a bang. It made a kind of foot noise. There was a massive earth tremor, but you didn't hear a bang. You know, this is a huge explosive charge, but it's deep underground. So it did not make a bang.
No, I didn't know that. No.
And this is backed up by other eyewitnesses, especially tunnelling officers that are there who describe it. Time and again, when they talk about Messines mines, they say it didn't make a bang. It made
a kind
of fut.
Something I didn't realise until recently is that there's 19 of them that were exploded, and they didn't all go off at the same time, did they?
No, they were supposed to. And they went to great efforts to
synchronize.
I don't think they had a wireless signal. They didn't have like a time signal like they have for, you know, the Battle of El Alamein or something, you know, where everyone's watches are the same. So they had to have like a master watch that would then go to Core HQ, and then everyone would correct their watch on that watch and that sort of thing. So the idea was that the mines would all go off at exactly the same time, and that the guns would then begin their opening bombardment, because there's no preliminary bombardment as such, at the signal of the mines.
Yeah.
So basically, the mines are all supposed to go off at the same time. So you're dependent on the tunneling officers with their watches in their hands and their like dynamo exploders with the plunger that they have to, you know, force
basic
down to set the mines off. Some of them were rigged up. The ones at Hill 60 were rigged up to a generator, so they were just pulling a switch that you can see in Australia, Warmborough, still in Canberra. So they were sort of throwing a switch. They have to do that at exactly the right time, and they didn't all get it right.
No.
So the eyewitnesses talk about as much as 20, 30 seconds interval between these mines going off.
Okay.
But nevertheless, as soon as the gunners felt, you know, saw the mines going off, they opened fire.
Yeah.
So that was a really good way of getting the guns synchronized.
Yeah.
And the eyewitnesses say it's not the mines you could hear, it's these guns going off.
Which makes
and
sense. It's the right time as well, isn't it?
No, 2,000. It's more than 2,000 guns in this opening salvo that are firing sort of almost simultaneously.
Heavy
and
guns,
obviously they could,
light guns,
yeah,
the whole mixture.
Yeah. I mean, it's well known that the guns could be heard across the channel.
Mm.
And there are plenty of accounts. And I actually found a newspaper account for about the 4th of June, 5th of June, where one of their assistant editors, who lives in Kent, in Beckenham, where I was born, actually, how coming home in the night, you know, he's been on the sort of late shift, as it were, comes home in the early hours of the morning, and not only can he hear the guns, but occasionally the windows are shaking in his house from the guns that are firing.
You can see now where that story came from then, can't you, when you look at it?
Yeah,
you
know? Yeah. So the crash of 2,000 guns opening up is what, you know, is what Lloyd George heard.
And
so
not just him, the whole of the southeast of England. It was,
and lots of people
could have
heard.
Opened
yeah,
people
if,
up,
it,
couldn't it?
if you were, yeah, I mean, I think if you were awake, and most people were obviously asleep at 10 past 3 in the morning, so Lloyd George was awake and listening out for it. So that seems much more plausible to me.
But so the bottom line is, the evidence is, there is no evidence. Lloyd George is not even in Downing Street, and even if he was, there is no evidence at all to suggest that that's what he heard.
No, but there's very powerful evidence, and he's not lying. You know, he thought he heard the mines.
No. It's just it was something else. He heard something, but it was actually something
he heard the
else.
guns. Yeah,
But it's still
but
an
what
equally good story.
yeah, but you said you mentioned a moment ago about in Lille,
About
a
the earthquake.
French city behind the lines. That's, I mean, that is an account by a professor of geology who was in Lille, who later told one of the British geologists after the armistice, he said, we felt that, and that people did rush out into the street. So that's a kind of slightly secondhand account, but it comes from the account of that geologist that that's what happened. And there are seismographs. There's one at Utrecht and one at the Isle of Wight that both detected it as well. So it's registered as a seismic event.
And I suppose if you're living in Lille, you're behind German lines. You wouldn't know anything about this. You've heard nothing like this before. Then you would think it was an earthquake, and you'd probably panic as well, wouldn't you?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I think that was exactly the effect of it. People ran out into the streets thinking that there was an earthquake.
Okay.
So it's there's truth there, but.
Yeah.
It also reminds us, actually, that this—it's not just mines winning the Battle of Messines. It's
guns.
It's the good old artillery as well.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, that's dealt with that one. So these 19 craters—they've killed 10,000 Germans, haven't they? Just like that.
Yes.
That's what I was told. I don't know where that came from, but I'm sure you'll tell us. And as part of that, the true story: did the Germans withdraw their frontline troops before the explosions? And if so, why did they do that? What's the true story then? What's the myth?
Yeah, there's two sort of questions really about did they kill these many soldiers? And also,
this is the key one, isn't it?
How effective were the mines? So, well, the 10,000 Germans, again, that's sort of, putting two and two together and coming up with a whole lot more. The 10,000 German source is actually the number of German soldiers missing at the end of the battle. Okay. And of course, missing means
prisoner of war.
Prisoners of war will include prisoners of war, any soldiers not accounted for.
Yeah.
So that figure is for a 21-day period, ending on the 10th of June 1917. So it's not just the moment of the mines going off, but also we know that from the British records that the British took 7,200 prisoners.
That's the majority of the casualties then, isn't it?
So you can deduct those. So you're left with 2,800 missing from the battle.
Yeah.
So we still maybe you could think that that's the number that are buried by the mines and lost and unaccounted
There's
for.
There's some more numbers to come off that, I suppose, is there?
Yeah. So, basically, I then looked at what descriptions there were of the mines going off themselves. And this is something that the British tunnellers were very interested to know. After the attacks in which mines were used, they would want to find the evidence of their success.
Yeah.
And I found with the Somme, actually, and the famous Lot Nagar mine, that the sort of estimates they make are really quite dodgy as to how many that their mines have killed, because they want to oversell. They want to emphasize the effectiveness of their mines. Give us more work, give us more men, because we're good at what we do. There's actually an officer who is a mining engineer named Ralph Stokes, and he was, if you like, the eyes and the ears of the officer in charge of the mining operations on the Western Front, who was based at GHQ. And Ralph Stokes would be sent out. He was called Assistant Inspector of Mines, and he would be sent out basically visiting tunneling companies and finding out what's going on, reporting back to his boss. So he goes to investigate, and he keeps a very detailed diary, luckily, as well, his reports about what he's seeing. So I know basically what Ralph Stokes finds. And Ralph Stokes went on, it's within a couple of days. In fact, it's on the day of the attack. Yeah. So the mines have gone off at 10 past three in the morning. On the same day, he goes to three of the mine craters to find out how effective they've been. And he goes to one at Ontario Farm, which actually, if you go today, there's not much of a crater. And it's the one where the explosives didn't properly detonate. I think they probably had what they call a conflagration. Some of the explosives didn't detonate, they just sort of burnt.
Right.
So there was a sort of half a mine going off.
Yeah.
And then for several days afterwards, the ground kind of bubbled like porridge because underground the explosives were burning
Almost like
and
a
throwing
volcano.
up gas. Yeah, throwing up
Yeah.
gas. So anyway, but they still, I mean, they're still partly detonated. They actually hurled several bunkers up in the air,
Okay.
these concrete bunkers. So he found that two of them had been lifted in the air, and one of them was completely buried. The second one, he managed to look inside, and he writes in his diary, he said that there were eight men in there. He said, all lying in a lump, dead. He said, we saw these at noon. And he said, at 7 in the morning, two had still been alive. And he said, one was wearing spectacles, which were still on his nose. So he's
There would have
looking.
been more, wouldn't there? There would have been a lot more that he would have seen.
Potentially. Well, yeah, I mean, basically, the Germans are holding their front line with men in the bunkers. And they have these bunkers sort of interspersed along the front line with maybe 10 men
Yeah, in
in
each
each
one.
bunker.
Yeah.
Stokes estimates that bunkers had these sort of little groups of men in. He says, judging from the dead scene around the craters and the distances between the posts, he thinks that each of the five southern mines at Messines killed between 10 and 20 men.
Really,
So he
each
looks
one.
at the mines, he thinks that each mine kills between 10 and 20 men.
So when you
And
multiply that up,
it's about 380
yeah,
killed
which is a lot
in
different,
total.
isn't it?
So obviously
Okay.
that's a lot less than 10,000.
It is, yeah. But I think the
So,
key is the prisoners that they've gone up there. The Germans are absolutely stupefied and stunned, and they've taken them prisoner, haven't they, rather than
yeah.
killing them.
So situation is more that the Germans are holding their front lines more thinly.
Yeah.
And we'll come on to sort
Yeah.
of look at that a bit more in a second, maybe. But they're also holding the line more thinly, so the mines are going to kill fewer.
Yeah.
Because they've moved over to a sort of defense in depth. And the effect of the mine, the effectiveness, is the shock value.
Yeah.
You know, what garrison there are, if you're not blown to pieces
They
or
put their
buried
hands
by
up.
the debris,
Yeah.
you're going to be completely stunned by the shock and awe
You're not going to be able to
of
fight, are you, against a load
no.
of New Zealanders charging up the ridge?
No. It's the shock value, and the front lines are just too thinly held.
Yeah.
There was a British story at the Spanbrook Molen mine. The Germans were actually conducting a trench relief, and so it greatly doubled the number of casualties. And this story has been impossible to verify from any German sources. I don't think it happened. And again, it seems that the same numbers of men were killed at the Spanbrook Molen mine. There was a story actually relating to the bunkers. Just like the bunker that Ralph Stokes saw at Ontario Farm that had been thrown into the air at the Spanbrook Molen crater, General Plumer's chief of staff, Harrington, Tim Harrington, went, I think it's on the day of the attack or the day after the attack, to the Spanbrook Molen crater. And he describes in his memoirs how he was conducted into a German bunker. And in the bunker, there were German soldiers seated around a table still. He describes how they looked just, you know, as they had been at the moment of the attack, and that they'd been killed by the shock of the explosion, propped them up on chairs and probably put some playing cards in their hands as well, and then invited in any passing staff officer to have a look. so
what
I don't believe that
them
they
to
were
do, really, isn't it?
exactly I don't believe that they were killed by the shock, seated still on their chairs in the bunker, but actually killed by the concussion of the mine. But the other aspect about the effects of the mines and the casualties that they caused is to do with the fact that the Germans were very much thinning out their front lines, and the Germans had changed their whole attitude to defense on the Western Front because of the effects of the Battle of the Somme, because they'd lost so many men during the Somme by trying to keep the front line as strong as possible and never give up the front line. They had devised new tactics, sort of flexible, in-depth defense tactics.
Had they done
and
this
this
on the
has,
Hindenburg line as well that they'd established during that
exactly,
winter?
so the
That's what they'd
Hindenburg
done
line is
over
very
Auschwitz,
much,
isn't it?
yeah, very much a part of this.
Yeah.
But as part of that, your line is going to be much more in depth. So the front line doesn't become the line which never falls. The front line becomes merely a series of outposts
yeah.
that will fall back at the time of the attack, and the attackers will be allowed to advance a long way before they actually meet any resistance. They'll have to advance even beyond the range of their own field guns, so they lose the protection of their own barrage.
So they're being lured into a trap, really, aren't they, I suppose?
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. Then only then do the Germans unleash their own barrage onto the attackers, and then counterattack troops who are waiting beyond the range of the Allied field guns, counterattack, and then, in theory, retake the lost positions. So the Messines Ridge and other kind of heavily defended front lines don't really work in that kind of new method of flexible defence. So the Germans have definitely thinned out the front at Messines Ridge. That led one historian, Dennis Winter, a few years ago, to actually claim that the Germans had withdrawn from Messines Ridge, which is completely untrue.
No, it was just their new way of defending. The new strategy for defending was to have a thin outpost of front line rather than actually withdrawing. So that's where that story's come from then, isn't it? Together with the 10,000 Germans that were killed, they were most of them taken prisoner. Oh, blimey.
but nevertheless, the Germans hadn't fully sort of implemented this. They looked at how well the flexible defence was going to work at Messines Ridge, and they'd actually decided that the defences further back weren't powerful enough to fully implement it. So they hadn't gone the whole way at Messines Ridge.
It was evolving, I think. It was evolving.
And it's very difficult psychologically for the German commanders to give up these very powerful positions that they've been defending for more than 2 years. Yeah. So it's not entirely, you know, you can't go as far as to say they'd withdrawn, but they were holding the front lines far more thinly than they had before. Mm. So it's a more complex story, but it's part of kind of our understanding of how the First World War was fought. Mm. And when I think back, you know, to back to sort of 30 years ago, how we really understood all of that, we're getting far more of a kind of complex understanding of what was going on during
those
4 years.
Well, it will never stop, will it? The learning will never stop. You know, we always say this. And, you know, in 30 years' time, if we're still around then, me and you can sit down and we'll look at this story in a completely different way, I suppose, won't we? But
if we can remember that we had this conversation.
We'll be sitting there dribbling. I'll edit that bit out. So, okay, the third one then, these Irishmen, they were killed by the debris of their own mine, weren't they?
Yes. So this is Spanbrook Molan.
Yes. Killed by their own mine.
Yes.
I mean, this has happened in previous mine explosions. It happened at the Hoo crater, didn't it, in 1915. Some men were killed there because they got too close to one of the first explosions. But what you're going to tell me is now this didn't happen at Messines.
Okay, so I mean, Spanbrook Molan, I mean, it's an incredibly evocative place, isn't it? Mm. You've got
the
mine crater called the Pool of Peace. It belongs to the Tokhatch organization. You know, it's a fitting memorial. Mm. And then just down the slope, the same slope that the British troops advanced, you've got this cemetery, little battlefield cemetery. Mm. The story is, and it's often told at that cemetery, and I may have done it, I probably did do it in the sort of early years, is the story that these men were killed by the debris of the mine and not by enemy action. And actually the origin of that I found was a misunderstanding in one of the maybe more famous books about Battle of Passchendaele. They called it Passchendaele. Lynn MacDonald, a book which got, you know, was one of the sort of early books that many of us read that got us interested in the subject, which is in many ways a great book, and her use of eyewitness accounts, pretty much following on to from, you know, the way that Martin Middlebrook, of course, at the Somme. So I couldn't reconcile the account that she gives of a casualty from that Spanbrook Molan mine. I mean, for a start, I couldn't find any accounts that actually described soldiers being killed by the debris from the Spanbrook Molan mine. Mm. And so looking at the units that attacked there, I mean, the thing about these attacks is that you know where everyone is. Every battalion has got its boundaries, and you know where exactly a battalion is attacking. So I couldn't find any reference in, say, the war diaries or eyewitness accounts for the units that actually attacked and captured Spanbrook Molan. And you can see I give you a sort of map on my blog as to which units it was. Royal Irish Fusiliers, Royal Irish Rifles.
But I think the credibility of that story, of what we're now proving is a myth, because there's no evidence, is that when you're there, it seems credible because as you come out of that cemetery, which is the front line, you're very, very close to the crater and you feel as though you're being overlooked by it. So in your mind's eye, you could imagine the spoil coming down. And of course, behind you in the cemetery are Irishmen.
Yeah.
I think this is where the myth has come from, isn't it?
Yeah. And also, I think even buried in that cemetery, some of them are from an area to the right, to the south.
It's one of the other
which
craters.
Is the truth in the story. There is truth in the story. Yeah. See, Lynn MacDonald, she quotes from an account by an officer in the 8th Royal Irish Rifles, Witherow. I think it was Tom Witherow. And he describes how, as they advance, one of his lance corporals was killed by debris. And he in the account that Lynn MacDonald quotes, and he says that the earth began to rain down on them because they'd actually advanced slightly too soon.
Yeah.
And he says, luckily only soft earth fell on me, but the lance corporal, one of my best section commanders, was killed by a brick. It struck him square on the head as he lay at my side. This happened, but he's in the 8th Royal Irish and they are not at Spanbrook Molan. They are at the next mines off to the right at Creestraat.
So only a few hundred yards away.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's truth in it, but it's just not exactly there.
Yeah.
And also, he's the only casualty that's recorded from these mines.
Yeah.
Now, there may well have been more. And Lynn MacDonald just made a mistake. She specifically says it's at Lone Tree Cemetery that these are killed, these men are killed, and buried, rather.
Yeah.
But she doesn't give any other evidence.
No,
and the evidence she does give is it's just an error. And it's maybe understandable at the time because it's so much easier for us to have this information at our fingertips. If you wanted to get a war diary when she was writing that book, you'd have to go to Kew and order up the documents and then write it all down in pencil.
You couldn't copy it easily, could you? No, that's right.
Now we can just call these records up on the internet and check them. There is this lance corporal, and I couldn't find out who he was.
No, he's the one. He's the only one. I've got another question for you, actually, which I only realised that when they detonated the mines on the Somme, famously, they were 2 minutes before 0 hour, given that period of 2 minutes for the Germans to prepare, which turned out to be a mistake. One of them was blown 10 minutes before the Hawthorne Ridgecrest mine. But 11 months later at Messines, it's a completely different tactic. They're detonating the mines dead on 0 hour. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. And this is a really major...
This is a learning curve, isn't it?
Messines, exactly. Yeah. Now, they should already have known on the Somme that you didn't need a delay because Saint-Éloi, which is on the Messines battlefield, March 1916, Blücher's Second Army had blown mines and they'd attacked, and initially they'd successfully captured the German positions. And they knew the lesson of that battle was you fire at zero because actually the debris falls a lot quicker than you think.
So on the Somme, they were being complacent, really, weren't they? Because they thought the Germans would all be dead.
Yes, they were. And
inexperienced men, not untrained men, inexperienced soldiers. They wanted to give them a little bit longer.
Yes, they just didn't have experience of firing these massive mines on the Somme. I think it's kind of complacency on the part of the Fourth Army.
In hindsight,
absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. We're not criticizing.
But there had been. I am.
I can get the stick on Twitter then.
I've been reading a lot of Fourth Army papers looking at the lead up to the Battle of the Somme, and I'm kind of my patience and understanding of General Rawlinson and his chief of staff are wearing a bit thin. But so basically, there had been in March of 1916, there were two sort of local mining attacks, the one at Saint-Éloi and the one at Hohenzollern Redoubt, where the British fired mines and then captured the craters. And the lessons from those attacks should have been incorporated into the Fourth Army planning for the Battle of Somme July, and they were not. And they delayed. So Lavoisel, the 2 minutes were not necessarily crucial and fatal, but
and
we know at Hawthorne.
And certainly not 10 minutes wasn't required then, was it?
10 minutes was 10 minutes was it's everyone regarded it as a disaster afterwards, I think, because it just gave the Germans that crucial time. So by the time of Messines, they absolutely know. You fire the mines at the point when your men are getting out of their trenches.
So there's absolutely no chance for the defenders to react in any way whatsoever. Before they know what's happened, they're stupefied, they're terrified, they're dazed, they're probably blinded as well, a lot of mist, everything else going on. Before they know it, the enemy soldiers are on top of them.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, that's it. Exactly. But even a few minutes can be enough, because the Germans are just so good at reacting. They don't need to be given orders. They're
trained.
And in the mine warfare on the Western Front, where mines will be blown under German positions or in no man's land, the Germans always seem to get the crater first. That was the sort of that was the feature of the Germans. So surprise had to be absolutely maximized. But that's why at Messines, zero was when the mines went off.
Yes.
So everyone took their zero from the mines.
That's a great example of how the BF and the senior, everyone involved has learned, haven't they? I know they should have learned quicker, that's what you're saying, but they've still learned, and all these lessons are then taken forward to 1918 as well.
Yes, exactly.
So the lost mines then. How did we end up with lost mines? Surely they were all blown, weren't they? I mean, did some of them get waterlogged or abandoned?
So when we say lost, we don't mean that they forgot where they put.
No, they mean abandoned.
At the time, yes. Yeah. So abandoned, really. This, I suppose, has become, or the thing that we always talk about when we talk about the lost mines, is the fact that in 1955, in a thunderstorm, this massive mine on the southern part of the Messines battlefield just detonated.
In the middle of the night, thankfully.
I think so, yes. Yeah. I think, and luckily, the only casualties were some cows that were killed by it. So, you know, so you're thinking, how could this have happened? How could they have forgotten that they had planted a mine of, you know, some 70,000 pounds of explosives?
They hadn't forgotten, had they?
Well, I think by 1955, they'd sort of forgotten. So there's two things going on here. So the mine that went off in 1955 is actually one of a cluster of four mines that were laid ready for the attack, but were never used because General Plumer decided he wanted to just narrow his front of attack, just to improve his chances of success. So these are down at the southern end of the battlefield towards or beyond Plugstreet Wood.
So they're outside the battlefield, really, aren't they?
Yes. Yeah. So they, so Plumer decided he wasn't going to attack, so they didn't fire them.
No.
And this happened a lot. I mean, all along the Western Front, actually, wherever there was mining, large explosive charges were laid for attacks that never happened.
So they must
or
still
just
be there
in case,
as well, then. They must still be and below the surface.
They are, yes. Yeah. And the records tell us where a lot of these are. Vimy Ridge, a few years ago, they recovered mines. And in fact, when I was at the Royal Engineers Museum, we explored those mines. And that was the thing that really got me interested in the subject. So seeing the remains of an 8,000 pound mine charge.
Yeah, I actually saw it.
In a tunnel.
Was that a bit nerve-wracking?
Well, I was with sappers that kind of knew what they were doing.
Right.
So you feel a lot safer going underground if you've got you've got Royal Engineers with you.
Yeah, definitely.
But it was it's just amazing. I'm not particularly claustrophobic, but I could see that you could maybe have a panic attack if you find yourself in an extremely narrow tunnel with detonator leads going into 100-year-old explosives.
You got the threat of carbon monoxide poisoning. You got also the threat of Germans tunneling the other way in a firefight or a camouflage being blown. You know, there's all these threats down there, aren't there?
Yes, Yes, yeah, so this is the whole. This is
Like at the
really
glory
what.
hole, we talked about the glory hole before we came on air, and that's the sort of thing that was going on there, wasn't it, in 1915, 1916?
Yes, and it's just this incredible hidden unknown battle. It's, even the infantry in the trenches only have a partial understanding of it, because sometimes they're deliberately not told about it because they're the ones that are going to be blown sky high if the tunnellers fail in their object of keeping the Germans back. So the okay, so four mines were actually not fired because General Plumer wanted to narrow the frontage of the attack. So when one went off in 1955, there's another three, left nearby that could, in theory, go off as well. Now, no one really knows why it went off in the thunderstorm.
No.
I think it was because lightning, I understand lightning can't penetrate 80 feet below the ground, even in this little wet ground. But the detonator leads will have been protected by what they call an armored hose, which is a sort of rubber canvas hose, but which has a kind of spiral metal protection.
Okay.
And that would be going, so the length of those detonator leads would be protected by the metal going right up to the surface. So if the lightning strikes the ground, that current, I think, could have gone through the metal of the
and been a conductor
armored
for it.
hose.
So what we're
And
saying
gone
is, if you're in that area to the south around Plugford, keep your eyes peeled for bits sticking out the ground.
Avoid thunderstorms.
Yeah,
avoid thunderstorms.
And don't go up there with a golf club.
Run away, yeah. So those are, so, and it wasn't, until fairly recently, it wasn't understood that that one that went off in 1955 was just one of four.
No.
So that brings the number of, lost mines up from one that went off to four.
Yeah.
But then, as I was sort of looking at the records of the Battle of Messines, I realized that there were other mines that were abandoned, not as a deliberate decision necessarily, but of necessity. And this is because during the preparation of the mines, the Germans got very close to finding the mines.
Right.
And you've actually got this underground fighting going on in places, and especially at places to the south of Messines, Putty Doo Farm, which is in the German front line.
Yeah.
So the British have got a charge underneath this farm.
Yeah.
But the Germans suspect that they're there. And a few places at Messines, the Germans suspected that they were there. They'd heard some suspected noises. And they started sinking shafts down to try to get down to this clay level. It's really hard to get through. You've just got a mass of wet sand above the clay beds underground. And the clay may be at 80 foot or so below ground, but you've got all this wet sand and the water can't drain through the clay. That's why it's wet in Flanders. That's why if you dig down, because it's sitting on top, it's not like chalk where the water drains through.
Yeah.
So it's incredibly difficult to sink a shaft through this wet.
Because that would immediately get waterlogged, won't it? The shaft would.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the Germans are trying to get down, and eventually they get down closer to where the British are, and they start detonating charges to try to destroy any British activity.
Okay.
And they actually succeed in cutting off the British access to the charge that they've already laid. It's one of these laid ready for June 1916. And the British realize that the harder they struggle to regain the access to their own mine, the more the Germans are going to realize that they're down there they're at the clay level.
Yeah.
And so they just realize that they've got to just abandon it.
Right. That's what they've done.
Reluctant as the tunnellers would be, they realize that if they keep, and especially if they use the usual tactic of detonating their own charges underground to destroy the German tunnels, give the game away. And also they risk detonating their own big charge as
of
well.
Course.
So,
so farm was destroyed.
Yeah.
It has been rebuilt in a slightly different position, a bit like Moquet Farm.
Just a bit. Yeah, it's just a bit south, just immediately south. So that charge is not exactly beneath the farm. It's
so
just
the farmers
the
are not
road.
Living on top of it, are they? Like some people.
No, but it's not much. It's not
you wouldn't
much
want to
difference.
Be there if it goes off, would you? I think whether it be night or day.
So the farmer, I gather the farmer is now aware, and he has been for some years.
Well, I hope someone's told him.
Sadly, I think they have. And but as to what it, how it affects his insurance, I just don't know. You know,
No, that's
these
right.
mines are a complete nightmare because
Yeah.
the difficulty and the danger of recovering them would far exceed, I think, the risk that you're
Leaving them
that is there
dormant,
from
the
them being
dormant
there, laying
one.
dormant. Exactly. So that was quite well known as the lost mine, La Petite Douve Farm. But I then found that there was another one.
Oh.
So one of the other mines, just to the north of Spandrup Molen, Peckham, the next
Oh,
one
the
along.
Peckham branch, you called this, didn't you, in your
Yes.
blog? Yeah.
So Peckham was a big mine laid under a German position. During the preparation for the attack, the British decided that they would also lay another mine from a branch tunnel underneath another position that had been another fortified farm. And the enemy here wasn't the Germans, it's just the ground conditions and the geology, because this wet sand that you've got that is so waterlogged that it's almost like it's like kind of quicksand. These tunnels through the dry clay that was very easy to work would hit a bed of sand.
That'd be too
And
soft then, wouldn't it? Too wet, too
yeah,
soft.
yeah. And they thought it was probably, the mining engineers thought it was probably an ancient riverbed
Oh,
that
really?
had cut down through the clay.
Gosh.
So suddenly they're digging through the clay, there's kind of clay kicking through the clay, and suddenly they hit the sand and immediately it starts pouring in.
It would
It
do,
pours
wouldn't
in,
it?
it's like liquid, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, within an hour the whole tunnel is buried.
They'd be submerged, wouldn't they, if
And
they weren't careful?
And they have to pump it out, they have to put in reinforced concrete blocks to try to keep out the sand and
It's
then
too
divert the
complicated
tunnel,
then, isn't it? It's too complicated.
Down.
Yeah.
And it gets, you're trying to conduct a massive civil engineering operation right underneath, you know, you're literally right under the German front line. So you just cannot, you cannot make any noise that
No.
will disturb the Germans. So
No,
they
abandon
reluctantly
that.
decide that they've got to abandon it. Yeah.
Okay.
So again, it's the geology,
Yeah.
the conditions that were
Yeah, and you don't
the
know that
reason
until
for
you
that.
go down there, do you? If you're a Royal Engineer, you don't know what you're going to find until you're 80 foot underground.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, these tunnels were dug under such incredibly difficult conditions. And the Battle of Messines, it's been likened to a, you know, a sort of massive civil engineering project done in the face of the enemy. You know, it's a sort of cross
Right under
rail.
their nose, literally right under their nose, isn't it?
Crossrail under the eyes and the ears of the enemy. Yeah, from researching other mining operations, is that the tunnellers just laid mines in case, and then no one was ever going to check. No staff officer was going to go down and check they'd taken them away. So they would tend to just leave them.
Yeah.
If they were leaving a sector, they'd just leave them there and
Well,
not
they've been
bother
there
to
for over
remove them.
100 years and only one's gone off, so I don't think we should feel too unsafe when we're wandering
Well,
across
also,
here following
yeah.
books.
And in the context of the unexploded shells and grenades that we see
Yeah, that's more dangerous,
all
isn't
over
it?
the battlefields.
Yeah,
Yeah.
that's
Yeah.
right.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, that's brilliant, Simon. Absolutely fantastic. Really grateful for that. But before, we've already mentioned the fact that you've got two books that you've written. Are they're still in print? They're still available from you?
Okay. So, yes, now the Underground Warfare book is just about, I've literally got 10 copies left of my book on underground warfare. So you can contact me through my blog and I can send you
That
those.
one.
The book I wrote about gas warfare, that's still available through Osprey Publishing, Gas Warfare, Weapons and Tactics. I'm actually at the moment working on a tunnelling equivalent to that for Osprey that will be available next year.
Oh, right.
And
Okay.
yeah.
Yeah. Before then, I see from your website, you've got some exciting tours that you'll be leading that are coming up later this
Yes,
year.
the
Talk us through those.
Yes, so the battlefield tour. So I'm actually doing a tunnelers tour
Yeah.
in September. So these are for a company called Cultural Experience. So tunnelers tour is in September. And again, I think I've put the info on my website. Next tour is actually on war poets. So as well as doing tunnelers, I do war poets.
Different subject altogether.
And also a new tour, partly new tour that I'm doing later in the year on the Marne and the Aisne. That I'm really excited excited about, you know, when you go to new places, it's
Yeah, you've
always
got to do all the
exciting. So
wrecking,
in
haven't you? All that sort of thing is great fun, isn't it, when you go there?
August, the Marne and the Ain, and I haven't been to the Marne since 2014, and I did a tour, 5 day tour on the 1914 Battle of the Marne. That is very little visited. That's just a stunning battlefield. It's kind of Napoleonic, the fighting, and because the fighting just passed over that battlefield, it wasn't destroyed. So you've got farms that the, you know, imagine these, like, you know, these Waterloo, Battle of Waterloo farms, you know, Hougoumont, that sort of thing. The same kind of things happening in 1914 around these farms, and they're still there.
They're
You know,
still there, yeah.
the roofs got burnt in 1914, and they rebuilt them.
And then they've moved on the next day, haven't they? I suppose they've moved on.
Exactly,
The race to the sea begins.
there's the wall of a French cemetery that's still got the holes that the troops made, the sort of loopholes for defending it during the fighting. So we're combining the 1914 Marne battle with the 1918 Marne battle, which
And they're
is
completely different, I suppose, aren't they? Completely
completely
different.
different, because obviously you've got 4 years of complete revolution in fighting methods, but both battles are turning points in the war. And I think the 1918, July 1918 Marne battle is still very little understood in terms of how important, because it was a French battle. You know, we focus on the British ones.
Definitely,
French, and also very much an American battle as well. So a lot of big American press. So those are things that are coming up, but the tunneling one is probably the one most relevant to what
What
we've
we're
been
talking
talking
about.
about.
And how can people book those tours? Is it through your website?
You can find the links to my website, or Google the cultural experience, and you'll find
Right.
those tours
I'll put a link
on
to it
their webpage.
on the podcast page on my website as well, so that if people go there, they can contact you that
Thank
way,
you.
and sign
And
up for
obviously
that.
that, and those blogs, you know, for free, you can read the
Yep.
blogs as well on my website about
And what
machines
I
and
suggest that people
other
do is what I've
subjects.
done, either have that with you on an iPad when you're touring on a machines battlefield, or do the old-fashioned way and print them off and put them in a folder. It does make more
Yes.
sense when you're on, like it always does, when you're on the battlefield, actually looking at the craters, looking at the battlefields, and it does make more sense, doesn't it?
Yes. And I did some overlays using Google Earth. I had a lot of fun for the one about the lost mines, where the actual plans, the tunnelers' plans, I found that I could just overlay them very, very neatly onto aerial photographs. So if you want to see where, you know, exactly where these unexploded mines are, you can go and
Use that.
stand on the same spot.
Brilliant. Oh, great. Well, that's a useful hour for me. I don't know about the listeners, but I've learned so much during this hour, which, as we keep saying this, don't we, that you never ever stop learning. When you go on tours, the people that you go on tour with, they give you lots of stories back, don't they? And
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
it is an
Yeah.
amazing experience, it really is. Thanks very much for that, Simon. And I can, just from what you've been talking about your tours, that I can feel I'm going to be asking you to do more of these in the future. So
Okay, I'd love to. I'd love to. It's been a lot of fun. It's
thank
been
you.
great, Terry.
So that's it for this week. Thanks again for tuning in, or downloading, or whatever the right phrase is. I'm back out on the Somme battlefields when you'll be listening to this, on another family tour. I've got three in June lined up, three different family tours, which I'm looking forward to. Yes, thanks for tuning in. If you could rate the podcast on Spotify or Apple, that really does help with the listening figures. And be back again in a week, 10 days' time. And until then, keep safe, and I hope to see some of you on the battlefields of either Ypres or the Somme or Arras or wherever we shall be in the next month or so. And we finish the podcast as usual by playing The Last Post in memory of all of the soldiers that lost their lives during the Battle of Messines in June 1917, wherever they come from in the world, and however many of those German soldiers were killed when those 19 explosions went off at 3:10 on that early summer's morning.